home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Welcome, welcome. Whether you're listening in the evening, in the morning, in the afternoon, welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson. Garrett Miller is off tonight. Hopefully we will have him back next week. Fingers crossed, microphone crossed. Tonight I have a really special guest, important guest, a VIP you might say, although he rankles at that description. But we have Brody Levesque, and Brody is the chief political correspondent for the New Civil Rights Movement publication. He has also got a vast experience as a premier journalist covering the LGBTQ arena for many years out of the Washington Bureau, a senior editor for LGBTQ Nation, and really the man with his finger on the pulse of what is going on in Washington, D.C., which brings me to why we have him on tonight, because let's face it, we can call it a whole lot of things going on in Washington, from shit show to cesspool to swamp filling up to whatever you want, but things are messy there right now. I made a list of about 9 different, separate, wholly different topics to talk, and talking to him before the show, he said, make sure you check my Facebook page because I got a few new ones. Like, okay, 9 is not enough. So anyway, and I did, here's the first rule: always do what Brody tells you, always. So yeah, I did check that out, and well, let's bring the man on now and get the party started. Hey, Brody, how you doing?
Yeah, good evening, and how are you, Rob?
I am doing well. just to add to kind of your whole credibility thing, I want people to know that you are the one, the single voice in the wilderness who called me the night before the election and gave me the real rundown on that Hillary might lose, that Hillary was probably going to lose, and how she was going to lose. And it went down exactly as you predicted it did. So just to let people know, I wanted to go right to healthcare, because that seems to be the thing that is happening right this minute. What a mess. I'm going to give you my take, and then you can pick it apart. Is that it is likely to fail at a vote, because you've got Republicans who are either against it because of the damage it'll do to many recipients, including loyal Trump people who think that Trump is going to save them, and they will be, severely awakened once the replacement comes through. And other Republicans who think that it doesn't go far enough, they are being threatened also by the Koch brothers, who are threatening to pull all funding, which is sizable, from their future campaigns, which is in 2 years, if they vote for it. So between the ones who like it for completely opposite or dislike it for completely opposite reasons, it is threatened to fail. Trump is threatening that, if they have to vote on it now, and if it doesn't go through, then, he's going to punish them by keeping Obamacare in place, which secretly I think he wants to do anyway. So there's my outsider take. What do you see from the inside?
The first thing is, at this point in time, and the White House has acknowledged this, they acknowledged it about a couple of hours ago, the president has already indicated that should the vote fail and not happen tomorrow, then he's going to simply move on. And that's the White House's way of saying that we're just going to leave Obamacare in place and we're just going to simply move ahead. At this point, Speaker Ryan does not have the votes. He's being blocked principally by the Freedom Caucus, but they are about roughly 40 votes down now at this point. And this is just within the Republican conference. This doesn't include, obviously, Democrats who are opposed to it. They've been trying, and they're, at this hour, they're still working on cobbling together, the legislation to make it work, but it really doesn't look as though it's going to. I don't know whether or not the administration is going
to
view this as
together,
a... I'm sorry, what now?
I just wanted to ask you a quick question in there. If they were able to pull that together in the House, it still has to pass the Senate, correct? And do you, let's say they somehow scotch tape it together, do you think it will go down in the Senate? I mean, will it have a harder time getting through the Senate then?
No, not at all. Senator Rand of Kentucky has already indicated that he is severely opposed to it. There has been questions from some of the other members of the Republican conference in the Senate. At this point, the legislation, the way it currently exists, first of all, if staff votes going to make it out of the House, second of all, that version getting to the Senate's not going to survive. It's going to have to go back to the conference committee, and then even that is going to have to get voted on. The sticking point here is that the conservative faction basically wants to remove all elements of the Affordable Care Act. And by doing so, it would literally, quite frankly, cripple the healthcare system. And this has been really the main point to it. The White House has already said that they're not going to approve of that. There are certain things that they wanted, to continue to take care of. But, the back and forth with it, the Freedom Caucus met with the president and the vice president today on health care. And, of course, one of the things that came out of that meeting was the fact that the Republicans were, at that point, the Freedom Caucus Republicans were proposing removing maternity coverage as one of many items that they wanted to, take out of the legislation. So there's been some back and forth, in terms of where this is probably going to go and what's probably going to come out of it.
Could we sit with the irony of that for just one second, just kind of breathe in the irony of the group of people who I can almost guarantee you would, cut their right arms off to prevent women in the country from ever having abortions are now trying to say, we want to make sure that you absolutely have a child if you get pregnant, but, oh, by the way, now we're not going to pay for your maternity care. Did I hear that right?
Pretty much. I mean, at this point, Republican Congressman Mo Brooks had basically said to us earlier today that it looks like there's probably 30 to 40 Republican no votes on the legislation, and that's a pretty sizable block of no votes. And again, even with the Freedom Caucus meeting with the president this afternoon and with the vice president, they're still pretty far apart on this legislation. And no one really thinks that Speaker Ryan is going to be able to put it all together. It just does not look like it's going to happen.
Well, I have to say, if somehow they mangled things up, so in that political speak that, different people got little bits and pieces and threw it all into one thing that they would consent to vote for, it made it out of there. The same beating up process happened in the Senate. It made it to Trump, and he signed whatever it was. Whatever that mangled thing would be that would go through that process in this time with so little intelligence and research and thought behind it would automatically have to be disastrous just because of how it was developed.
Well, the other part of this, too, is that some of the things that the Republicans want to remove includes emergency services such as ambulance transportation, hospital care as far as ER rooms go, maternity and newborn care, mental health and substance abuse treatment, prescription drugs would drastically be reduced or eliminated altogether, rehabilitation services, physical therapy, speech, occupational therapy is gone. Lab services gone. Preventive care, some of which is now under the ACA, covered without a copay or the cost sharing, that would go away. Pediatric care, including dental and vision care for children, you know, that would be something that would go away. The conservative caucus is basically saying that these essential benefits push the cost of health insurance up and force people to buy health plans with more coverage than they need. Well, that's not actually true. All right. But this is kind of part of the problem. Now, by removing this, all right, yeah, okay, so you're going to get some cheaper plans, but overall, okay, consumers are going to find themselves in positions where they have health plans that don't cover things that they may need. All right. For example,
the things you were just talking about, the for example, prescriptions. I know for HIV meds and people who have to take those, if they have to pay for them out of pocket, even 50% out of pocket, you know, you're talking $3,000, $4,000, up to $10,000 or more a month. I mean, that's how much a lot of those meds cost out of pocket. I mean, it's, you know, seriously, this is not making America great again. This is making America sick again. So then it's ever been. I mean, physically ill.
It's one of the things that, you know, as the Los Angeles Times pointed out this afternoon, and I think this is kind of important, you know, if a health plan without prescription drug coverage might sound good when someone's healthy, it would be catastrophic if that same person were diagnosed with, say, cancer. All right. Now, secondly, making consumers pay for only the benefits they need, yeah, that might lower the cost of skimpier plans, but it would make plans that cover extra things like mental health and maternity care astronomically expensive, and which would effectively, okay, penalize anyone who's sick or needing medical care. And again, I'm paraphrasing the Los Angeles Times here.
Right.
And then, of course, the last point is that insurers might decide that they don't want to offer plans with extra benefits, because most insurance companies don't want customers who incur higher medical costs that they might have to cover. Translate that into pre-existing conditions as a benefit, okay? Now, that's kind of where the situation is with it. And, you know, at this point, because there's so much opposition coming from 30 or 40 members of the Freedom Caucus and more to the right members of the party, you know, Ryan basically has a revolt on his hand. It's very, very doubtful he's even going to be able to push through a vote tomorrow.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah. I mean, and to be honest with you, I'm really glad that it's such a train wreck for whatever reason, even though the people who are train wrecking it are ones who want to make it even worse than it is right now. Which is so, so bizarre. I mean, it's just,
well,
the Republican Party has got to grow up. I mean, healthcare is complicated. It is complicated. And for them to come in and have one goal of this cost reduction blindly, no matter what the consequences, sure at best and greedy at the worst. I mean, they're out of line. So anyway,
the administration is basically telegraphing. I spoke with one of my sources in the White House about an hour and a half ago, and the president has already basically, you know, told his staff that, you know, this thing doesn't come to a vote, or if it fails tomorrow in the House, we move on. So and he did publicly threaten that.
That's his best interest. Yeah. So then he can whine about health care for the next 4 years, although I don't know that he'll be around that long. But as long as he's here, he can whine about health care and blame it on Obama, which is his favorite thing. So, you know, it's sort of a win-win for him. He blames the Republicans for not passing it, and he blames Obama for what exists, and he, you know, does his Teflon thing. So, you know, anyway, that's my perception into the mind of Donald Trump, if you will. Speaking of which, let's move to my number two, my two of nine, wiretapping. What is going on with that sicko?
This has become a subject that has got a lot of misinformation out there, even in more credible media sites and sources and organizations. As you know, one of the Russian lawmakers that was testifying about corruption in Ukraine and the Putin influence was assassinated this morning in Kiev. This same gentleman who was killed also had working knowledge of Paul Manafort's activities, and therefore that looks a little suspect. So I'm going to take that for a minute and extrapolate what's probably going on. Last Friday, the FBI Director Comey met with the Senate Judiciary Committee. Afterwards, Chairman Grassley and Vice Chair Senator Dianne Feinstein came out and talked to us, and they were extremely grim, white-faced, and whatever the director told them shook them pretty bad. They wouldn't comment on it. And she made an oblique comment at a fundraiser in California over the weekend that maybe it was possible that the president would, you know, hang himself and that would be the end of it, and you have to resign. Now, as you saw, witness Director Comey went in front of the House committee, and he couldn't say very much. And, of course, there's a couple reasons for it. The material that he knows, of course, obviously is extremely sensitive, and it can't be put out in public, and which was frustrating, I'm sure, to the representatives on the podium, but also to the American public watching. From sources and from people that I know, including some very credible journalists who have been working on this story for a very long time, there's a lot of questions that are raised with this because it goes more to the point of, you know, first of all, when you talk about the president's claims and tweets about the Obama administration wiretapping him, those have been pretty much charged off as false. They're just simply fabrications. In terms of the overall scheme of what was going on, this is continuing a developing story. And again, you've got so much smoke, there actually probably is a fire. The thing is it's almost an impossibility now to tie all the threads together in such a way for it to make sense, particularly since a lot of this material is so sensitive, it's not being disclosed, and there's little bits and pieces of it. There is...
But Bertie,
circumstantial evidence
so
that
when
shows
say,
that
when you say that you know it you can't piece it together, can someone piece it together, or the people behind the scenes who are seeing the classified information, are they seeing the whole story in your opinion?
Well, I'm saying from the standpoint of the average layperson cannot piece it together predicated on the current coverage.
Right.
Those of us that are involved in covering it, yeah, we can put it all together. But again, it's when you're looking at this puzzle, you don't necessarily have all the pieces because of the dynamics of it. And yes, some of the information is in fact classified. But it's become patently obvious that there is in fact something very, very serious going on. Now, the major questions that people are asking, first and foremost, was whether or not the Trump campaign was in fact colluding with the Russian officials in terms of the election process. In other words, Russian interference. Okay? The second part of it
right.
is whether or not, through the course of the many years of his business practices and business dealings in Russia, that there was something else afoot there that would be influenced directly by disclosure from the Russian government, be it the Russian president or someone within the Russian government hierarchy. Okay. So in other words, it has been intimated several times that the Russians are holding something over the president's head. The question would be, of course, what? Now, I'm not speaking towards the dossier that Mr. Steele wrote. What I'm speaking of is other information that's out there. The dossier that Mr. Steele wrote had a tendency to be a little bit salacious in the nature of what it was really saying. The type of
right.
thing that is being alluded to goes beyond that kind of salacious information and, quite frankly, has nothing at all to do with it. So that's that part of it. And the final part of it is whether or not there was collusion by the campaign to do damage to not only the Democrat National Committee, but the Democratic candidates, in this case, the front runner, Secretary of State Clinton. So those are your three major pieces to this. At this point, it's a matter of tying all the threads together to figure out, you know, where does this stand and where does it go? You know, the wiretapping issue only dwells into it because he tweeted about it, and of course, it's just simply not true. And that right. came back from several people. And the president at this point can say whatever he'd like to say, but his credibility rating right now is pretty low. I mean, the last public policy polling had him yesterday at a 37 approval rating. That's pretty bad. So, yeah, right. and his credibility right. rating is even worse. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't take too much count into it. Well, but that's kind of an overview of the situation.
In your opinion, is this wiretapping mm-hmm. his behavior around that? Is that another, you know, throwing a smoke bomb over in the corner and saying, oh, look at that over there, and trying to divert attention rather than the real hotbed of what is happening in the Russia discussion?
I think that, you know, Senator Franken in Minnesota was calling it gaslighting, and I kind of tend to agree with the senator that this really is a case of the White House gaslighting the American public and, of course, those of us in the press corps. I don't see, first of all, and this is kind of important to note, and I watch the daily briefing, and Spicer is disingenuous at best, a liar at the least. This is true of most right. of that White House, including the president. So it's virtually right. impossible to tell whether or not there's anything credible, you know, with any sense of veracity coming out of that building. Now, I would tend to doubt it, and from what I'm seeing from my colleagues that are sitting in the chairs in the Brady briefing room, they're in the same boat I'm in terms of the way we view, you know, this administration. Do I see him as gaslighting the American public and the press? Yeah, absolutely. I think the wiretapping tweets have a great deal to do with that. It's a classic. If you don't want someone looking here, then throw a bomb over here, and while their attention is diverted, you know, you try and cover up the other one. So yeah, I
right.
agree with that.
And in this case, kill off the witness.
In this case, I think it's just to basically throw, you know, the press off and throw the public off. And again, I would say that whatever it was that, you know, Director Comey told the Senate Judiciary Committee is of some significance, and what he alluded to in his House testimony pretty much backed up the facial expressions of Senator Grassley and Senator Feinstein. Yeah, I've had a lot of interaction with both of those senators, and just Grassley's face alone was enough for me that, yeah, okay, something's really, really not kosher. Something's really bad here. Feinstein looked
right.
very grim.
Well, you know,
the last time I saw her face look like that. I'm sorry? The last time I saw Senator Feinstein look like that was the day Harvey Milk was shot. So, yeah, it was that kind of a face.
Wow, yeah. Well, it's sort of when you step back and just look at the players, it's not really
mm-hmm.
hard to guess what type of thing it could be. I mean, it's simply that, you know, that memo that came out that you alluded to, which, you know, whether it's true or not doesn't even really matter. It, you know, alludes to, you know, that they have different sexual practices with prostitutes caught on secret
mm-hmm.
videotape, which makes it sound really, you know, I mean, in terms of Donald Trump at this point, it's like so big deal, you know, whatever. You know, it's no worse than what we caught on the, you know, from the trailer in NBC, you know, so whatever. But the fact is more to the point of why he would be in a hotel room in Moscow in the first place. I mean, we know he's a wheeler dealer. He's a big wheeler dealer. You know, he's a, you know, I'll do this for you, you do this for me. It's always about big, big money payback and, you know, lining his pocket. And the Russians are unscrupulous, and they will, you know, I'm sure we're buying a lot of favors and a lot of things and a lot of stuff, you know, in exchange for setting him up. I mean, it's like it just seems really, it almost would be uncharacteristic if it was something other than that, or if something other than that happened.
I, you know, from my perspective, looking at the situation, The entire thing that was alluded to in Mr. Steele's dossier about a hotel room, yada, 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 that's all just, it's irrelevant, okay? It has no bearing. What has more of a bearing is the fact that this man, Trump, has been doing all these crooked business dealings for years and years and years, and whatever business dealings he had with the Russian government or maybe even the president of the Russian Federation himself, you know, was a tit-for-tat, quid pro quo, when it came down to getting him elected to office. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened, but that's certainly the appearances that it has taken based on what's out publicly. So you would look at that and go, Trump is owed, you know, Trump owes something to the government of Russia for helping him get elected, if that's in fact the case. You know, there's been a lot of allegations of Russian hacking that had to do with the election process, and, you know, most of which is, you know, patently false. But the fact does remain that the Democratic National Committee was, in fact, hacked. Those emails were, in fact, disclosed. They were dumped into WikiLeaks. There is enough substantial, circumstantial prima facie evidence that elements of the Russian structure that does that type of hacking, all right, was possibly involved, and many of them, in fact, do work for the Russian government, okay? But in terms of looking at an overall view that this is about him getting, you know, what was that one ludicrous charge of golden shower and prostitutes, that's irrelevant. People need to move away from salacious rubbish and start looking at the reality here. If this man colluded with the government of the Russian Federation to become the 45th president of the United States by taking out, okay, the opposition party and taking out the opposition party candidate, then that is a direct interference in the American electoral process, and that in and of itself is what the problem is. I get a little angered with my colleagues in my my peer group that keep banging away at the golden shower stuff in Steele's dossier. It doesn't freaking matter. This
right.
goes back to Watergate. Right. This goes back to the Washington Post. We learned this with the Nixon White House. Follow the money.
Right. Well, and you could not do better than with this individual. I mean, he is, I swear to God, he does not have blood in his veins. He simply has a financial statement, you know, roaring
mm-hmm.
through there. That is the only thing that seems to make him tick at all. So let's before we move on from this, because you and I
mm-hmm.
talked about sort of the doomsday scenario, what happens,
mm-hmm.
you know, if, you know, this all comes out in whatever way, you know, and he presumably resigns. First question, does Pence go with him or is Pence sitting pretty? Second question, what about presidential pardons? How do they work into this?
If, you know, well, the first problem that you've got is constitutionally, there's only two ways that this can go now at this point. And it's either articles of impeachment coming out of the House of Representatives and trial in the Senate, or he resigns. Now, let's say for whatever reason that he does resign. Unlike Richard Nixon, this person has no morals and no cares or whims because he doesn't quite frankly care. He would probably pardon himself, virtually all of the cronies that were involved, and he'd walk out the door whistling a happy show tune from Broadway. Seriously, I'm not joking. He would do that.
Right.
This is not like Richard Nixon. Nixon refused to do it, and, of course, Ford decided to do the right thing. Trump wouldn't. Trump is the type of person he would pardon himself, and I need to stress this to your listeners. According to your Constitution, the pardon power of the American presidency is absolute. There is no caveat to it and no restrictions. So that translates to this. If Trump pardons himself, that means he's clear from diapers all the way up to the time the pardon ink dries. And that's it. You can't touch him. Done. Same thing holds true for anybody else he pardons. Then he walks out the door. Now, that's part one. Part two, parents. Dependent upon if he was involved in the pardon process or dependent upon whether or not the vice president was actually involved in anything that quite frankly would qualify him to be impeached or removed from office, then he would be the president of the United States. If not, you are looking at, essentially, constitutionally, President Ryan, because the speaker is third in line. And that's it. And that's exactly
right.
What would happen. If
right.
you're, if POTUS
right.
and V-POTUS go, the speaker becomes the president of the United States. Now, the shambles that a Trump resignation is going to cause will be severe, because there's going to be repercussions for this, lots of them. This is not going to be a situation where, as the American nation went through many years ago during the Nixon resignation, resigned, he goes on a helicopter, Gerry Ford gets in there, our long national nightmare is over, away we go, a couple months later we pardon because we don't want this to continue, and off we are, okay? That won't happen this time. And the reason it won't happen this time is because the presidency itself has already been damaged. The American government, the American institutions of government have already been severely damaged. This is not a quickly recoverable event. On top of which, you also have to understand that the presidency of the United States is looked at also from a global point of view. The damage that this man has already done to the American presidency has already had severe repercussions in capitals all over Western Europe and elsewhere around the globe, including Beijing. So these are also factors that need to be considered as well.
Right. So can you go into that a little bit more on the damage that has been done specifically?
The most important coin of the realm in international relations has always been American stability and American prominence, and the fact that the Americans have always been the basis for stability. And Trump has upset the cart with this. And he's proposing, for example, another $1 billion cut to the UN budget. He's made statements about NATO. You know, at this point, his credibility standing, at least in Western capitals, is less than none. And quite frankly, the title of leader of the free world has pretty much transferred over to the German chancellor, because the British prime minister, unfortunately, she's a little bit of a UK version of Trump light. So it's an influence thing. American influence is also, I mean, American influence, Rob, has been the most important thing in post-World War II. Diplomacy, relations, and military strength. Now, it's not necessarily the fact that the Americans are a mighty military. It's the fact that the Americans have always been the first one out there. They've kind of been a global policeman, if you will. They have been the go-to for disaster. They have been the go-to for peacekeeping. Now, suddenly, the American government has been damaged and radicalized, and that makes people in other countries extremely nervous, particularly the Western allies.
I guess my question is, you know, if this transpired, you know, wouldn't it mm-hmm. also be a testament to, in a weird sort of way, the system, quote-unquote, working, removing the culprit, removing the bad policies that were him, not necessarily the presidency? I mean, it's, you know, I'm going back to what you said in terms of irreparable, where I'm not quite sure, you know, that the damage would almost be worse if he continued, but whatever removal of him, you know, and Paul Ryan would be a very weird one to go into to turn that tide. But that would be what I would expect him to do, especially internationally. But even
the problem. The other part of this equation is the part that it's a little bit, it's not quite so tangible, and it's a little bit harder to put your thumb on. But the American political process has been sliding into an abyss for just about 40-something years. It essentially had its foundations in the Watergate scandal, but with each succeeding Republican administration, it's actually gotten worse. And, of course, the Clinton administration, quite frankly, didn't help out much. By the time you got to the Obama administration, and you've got an administration that's essentially unable to govern because of what's happened over the last 40-some years. So this is, there's been a long time coming for this. This isn't just something that suddenly occurred with, you know, the January 20th inaugural of Donald Trump. This has been building. This has a long, long history. The American political process has been severely damaged, most importantly because the Americans have allowed the religious right to interfere in the political process. That they are, in fact, the number one leading influence. The second influence, of course, has been, you know, the corporate uber wealthy, such as the Koch brothers, that have dictated special interests and political action committees and things like that. So it's an in tandem sort of thing. Those two elements have chipped away and eroded, and then you have one more factor, and the third factor in this trioka, or the third leg of the stool, if you will, is the emergence of a very powerful conservative right-wing media that has just completely propagandized what the other two legs of the stool, if you will, have been doing. So, and this has been going on for a while. So it's a little unfair to just lay this all on Trump.
I guess I would look at a couple of other factors, though, and I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying in terms of that stool and those elements and everything else. My concerns on the Trump situation are twofold. One is the trumpets that are out there, which are that uninformed, uneducated part of the public that listens to that one conservative, you know, journalistic fake news. I mean, if anybody's putting out fake news, it's them, you know, to this group. And, you know, their leader is toppled, resigns, goes off, you know, and they're still in a, you know, screw the government, we want to break it kind of mode, which is, you know, the simple shorthand of what got him into office. But the other thing, and this is what I really see as being the thing that hamstrung the Obama administration, it, and even though there is some philosophical driving behind it, but it's more pragmatic, is the gerrymandering that happened because so many of the states had Republican governors. They gerrymandered their states. They set up their districts so that the House would virtually, you know, for the foreseeable, long-term foreseeable future, be in the hands of the Republicans. And to
well,
me, that's
again,
the core.
Again, but see, this takes a while to do this. This doesn't happen overnight. And these Trump supporters that you keep referring to, yeah, these people just suddenly didn't, you know, pop up out of nowhere. It's generational. And you can lay the blame on this directly back to the religious right and its hyper-racist movements going all the way back to the 1920s during the time of the, you know, evangelical tent movement, which unfortunately also correlated with the movement of the lynchings in the American South and the racism of the Jim Crow era. There is a historical basis for this. These people just suddenly didn't pop up one day. These Trump people are, you know, third, fourth generation. This is all, you know, taught and learned behavior. It's not the type of behavior that someone just wakes up one day and decides, I'm going to be a xenophobic, racist, homophobic, you know, douchebag. It doesn't work that way. But and this is the whole thing. One of the reasons that they are like this, and one of the reasons it's so successful, is because the religious right has made it a mission to get elected onto local school boards and at state levels, and they have been eroding the educational system of the United States, which used to be a top-notch educational system, and now, unfortunately, it produces generations of very ignorant people, such as Trump supporters. So there is historical context to this. The problem is when you start having these discussions, you're probably going to get one of two reactions. If you're around one of the Trump supporters, they're probably going to try and lynch you. And if you're around a progressive, no, it's not that, it's this, it's that, it's that. It's like they're just a disconnect. The reality of this goes back many years, and a lot of it got its roots. The conservative movement really got a boost during the FDR administration, all 12 years of it. because they saw this as intrusion and government overreach, and a lot of that was being preached on Sunday by these right-wing preachers. And these people used their position from FDR's time all the way forward. The Obama administration essentially only had two things it did right. Okay? One, it was able to successfully navigate the waters of government by governing by fiat or executive order. And the second thing it was able to do was to tie together enough elements of the younger progressive movement to get the Affordable Care Act passed and out there and get people start signing up and realizing it really wasn't all that bad of a thing. And, of course, the other signature of the Obama administration was essentially establishing, you know, human rights for once for the LGBTQI community. Outside of that, there's not a lot that the Obama administration was able to accomplish, and it was principally because, again, it came right up against what had been building particularly hard for the last 30 or 40 years and really got a kickoff with the Reagan administration. So this is one of these things that you have to look at this stuff in context. You can't just say, well, it's this, this, and this. You know, Trump and his supporters just didn't come out of nowhere. All right.
I agree with that, although I see some more nuances of Trump supporters than all one color, because I see the element that you're referring to, you know, the homophobic, bigot, xenophobic element to that. But the environment that Trump has created has given that part of, I'm going to use this word loosely, the Trump community voice and standing. And certainly that right-wing press that you're talking about is allowed things that were just, you know, pretty much, you know, verboten because they were just not acceptable in our society, and it's given them airspace and platform that they didn't have before. And I think the effect of that is more something to look out for on what it's going to have moving forward. But that being what it is, there is also this kind of other part of the Trump support, which now is getting pretty mushy, to be admittedly. But, you know, it's like the ones that were almost counter to the results of some of the things you're talking about. I mean, let's look at just step back a second. The Congress, the House of Representatives, who were completely obstructionist for Obama. They were not going to, if Obama said, you know, let's abolish taxes altogether, they would have said no, just because he said it. You know, it's like they were, that was their mindset. They were going to obstruct no matter what. So they're in an environment right now where they should just be flying high. And what are we looking at right now? They aren't going to be able to pass their health care bill because they do not know cooperation. It's not even philosophical. They just don't know cooperation. They're still fractionalized. And when they're in control and they have their own freedom, that's what's coming out, is they have not even taught themselves any means of collaborating or communicating or conceding, or, you know, none of that is part of it. It's my way or the highway, and none of them, to their surprise, is philosophically in charge of their own group. So, you know,
it's important to note this, and I'll stop you. It's important to note this, okay? None of the majority of the Freedom Caucus and some of the other caucuses in the House, and I'm going to leave the Democrats out of this, just the Republican conference, supported Trump initially during the campaign and during the candidacy. Okay? Same with the Senate.
Right.
And what happened was, and this is really kind of important to note, Donald Trump is a Republican in name only. He is a literal rhino, just like he's managed to galvanize the religious right, but the man's a bloody atheist. You can tell just by what
it's ridiculous.
Background.
No, absolutely
okay?
true.
But
yeah.
The thing is that they saw him taking the White House as their opportunity to have a unified government whereby they could pass their wish list of reengineering the government, social, whatever the programs were that they wanted that was on their agenda. And they had a willing ally with the president. Didn't matter if it was the EPA to rolling back, you know, clean air, clean water, didn't matter. Everything was on their shopping list they thought they could get. What they didn't get was that in within their own conference, there was fragmentation. This is the exact thing that happened to Speaker Boehner. There is, again, precedence for this. So Ryan has got the same problem that Boehner had when he was Speaker, and that is
right.
He's got an unruly caucus that he cannot control. It doesn't make any bit of difference who's sitting at the other end of the avenue. See, this is the one thing that people really don't understand. The assumption by the American public is that all the power is vested in the executive, and that's actually not true. The power is actually vested in the Congress. And the perception is that it's the president that does this and the president that does this and the president that does that. Actually, no. It is, in fact, Congress. So when Congress isn't working too well and not firing on all eight cylinders, which is the current case, all right, particularly within even a conference in one side of the aisle, it becomes a major problem. So looking at this, you have to look at what these factions are. The ones that want the complete repeal of the Affordable Care Act, they don't really want anything to replace it. They don't care. This is a bottom line. They do not care. Okay? That's
right.
Just it. They believe in an archaic political ideology that just simply has no place in the modern day and era. These people do not understand that a governance by a community, it is a requisite to have a government that operates, that covers everything. You cannot not have it. The time for that passed away during the New Deal, okay, 70, 80 years ago. But see, these people still hold on to this idea that this is how it's got to be. This is a classic Robert Taft conservatism coming straight out of the 1930s and fighting with FDR and the Roosevelt administration. It's the same theory. It just won't work. They don't understand that this country is at a point with its society and its citizenry that you can't do that. Yeah, you can really pull back.
And the irony,
you're going to end up with having all sorts of – let me finish. You're going to end up having all sorts of problems with just practical things, okay? You can't privatize everything because it just simply doesn't work, and they don't get that.
Right.
Now, that
right.
translates into them blocking legislation within their own conference, just like we're seeing now with their version of the Health Care Act.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's pure libertarianism that is, you know.
It's not even libertarian.
No, it is. I mean, that's what libertarianism is, you know, the idea that the economy, you know, if it's left unfettered, that economic rules will right the economy and do the right thing, which, you know, it only works theoretically in economics classes. And when in the real world, it's never worked because it's always been adjusted. And as soon as you adjust, you're gone and it doesn't work. I mean, I'm really agreeing with what you're saying. I mean, it just does not work.
Nope, not at all.
The irony is that the people who voted in Trump, you know, they don't,
mm-hmm.
you know, these are knee-jerk people. These are not people who are sitting down and analyzing things in depth. But the knee-jerk reaction that they were reacting to was that whole group of 500-some people in the House of Representatives who have done nothing and have kept the government doing nothing for years, and that's the ones that they were really going after when they wanted to, you know, show Washington and drain the swamp and do all that stuff, and they're going to send Trump in there to, you know, to break things up. And they elected the same people again. You know, it's like they it's sort of, again, you know, doing one thing for show and doing another thing that is, you know, okay, if you're really serious, put the other party in the House. You know, if you really want to shake things up, put the other party in.
And we could debate this in a whole different program. At the end of the day, it boils down to this. The people that are going to be the most adversely affected by Republican policies are going to be the very people that voted the president in. That simple.
Oh, that's exactly my point. You and I are going to the same direction. It's like the people who think they wanted what they wanted are the ones that are the first ones really who are going to be hit. And, you know, it's unfortunately not going to be surgical, you know, to them. That would almost be, you know, just desserts. But the fact is it's going to, you know, dovetail out to a lot of innocent people who should not be hurt as well. But, yeah, it's, you know, the people who are most welfare, most hard hit, most needing affordable health care are red state people.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Bottom line. Yeah, absolutely. So we, you know, since we're down to our last 9 minutes and we only got to number two, I guess we actually got to three on my list of nine. Let me jump ahead. Well, let's cover the whole government. We're going to make this a whole government show. So, Supreme Court, hearing on the Supreme Court. We've got a nominee in front of the Senate right now. One of his cases just was overturned by the current Supreme Court, which sort of sends a very odd message. Tell us about this guy. What's going on?
Judge Gorsuch serves on the U.S. 10th Circuit Court of Appeals out of Denver, Colorado. The decision that you're referring to actually was overturned while he was sitting in Senate testimony across the Hill. It had to do with a case with an autistic kid. The problem with Gorsuch is that he's very disingenuous and way far to the right, even more so than Scalia would have been. We got word earlier today from Senator Schumer's office that the senator fully intends to filibuster the nomination. So that essentially means it'll be dead on arrival. Whether or not
I hear you on the filibuster part, but can you go into that, how he is more far right than Scalia? And here's where I'm confused on what's going on. Because the one part of the hearings I did watch was regarding Roe versus Wade. Dianne Feinstein, you know, wasn't even, you know, a Republican senator, quote unquote, grilling him. And I use that very lightly because she was not only softballing him, she was practically handing him answers, you know, that made him, I mean, I sat there watching it, and if I had been on the other side, if I had been,
let me go through, since we're running out of time, let me run through them real quick. All right, while he was sitting on the 10th Circuit, the first major case that was upheld by the Supreme Court was Hobby Lobby versus Sebelius. Okay, this, of course, as you know, was the craft store chain that sued to challenge a requirement in Obamacare that the employer's insurance policies must cover all forms of birth control. In a 5-4 decision, they upheld Judge Gorsuch's agreement. Okay. In his opinion, Gorsuch argued that the Obamacare would force businesses to underwrite payments for drugs or devices that can have the effect of destroying a fertilized human egg. Okay. His quote from that ruling, "It is not for secular courts to rewrite the religious complaint of a faithful adherent or to decide whether a religious teaching about complicity imposes too much moral disapproval on those only indirectly assisting wrongful conduct." In other words, what he's saying there is he believes that any form of birth control, abortion, what have you, is wrongful and immoral. Okay. All right. One of his other major decisions, it was in the case of Little Sisters of the Poor versus the Aged versus Burrell. This is a 2015 case. All right. This was in a ruling that basically allowed, where the health care law had allowed nonprofits to opt out, the Catholic Little Sisters had suggested that the law still substantially burdened their religious exercise. Okay. His quote on that: "When a law demands that a person do something that the person considers sinful, and a penalty for refusal is a large financial penalty, then the law imposes a substantial burden on that person's free exercise of religion." In other words, he's a big one on that one. Then the other one, the other ruling that he did to get everybody going was Gutierrez Brazella versus Lynch. This was just last year, okay? This was an immigration case, all right? Essentially, what the judge did was he argued that courts are better arbitrators when it comes down to weighing the legality of government regulations and rules versus the executive who normally would, you know, do that, all right? Another hot case of his, also from last year. This is the Planned Parenthood case. Planned Parenthood versus Planned Parenthood of Utah versus Governor Hubert. Okay, basically, the 10th Circuit overruled the lower court's ruling. But here's what he said: it is undisputed that the governor was free as a matter of law to suspend the funding in question for this reason. The reason being, okay, in the dissent, that the ruling was inconsistent with uniform practices regarding burden of proof and legal significance. So he kind of walked around that one. And then the list goes on. So if you look at his rulings and decisions, it is vastly polar opposite of what he said, if he said anything at all, because he danced around most of these during his confirmation hearings. He said, right, for example, right, on Oglethorpe, the law for, obviously, same-sex marriage, that it was settled off. But you look at some of the things he's done in the 10th Circuit, yeah, it doesn't look that way.
And did he do those things before it was settled, or did he do those things after it was settled and still rule the way he did?
This is just, these are his rulings I've given you going back for this case law. I mean, I can take case laws all the way back.
But I'm asking the timing on those things, whether Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage come down after he made those rulings, or did the Supreme Court case come down first and he still made those rulings?
No, he's an appellate judge. So basically, these are his rulings that the high court either weighed in on or didn't weigh in on. Okay. In other words, he's an appellate judge. He sits on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals.
I understood. I'm still trying to determine timeline, because because I heard him talk about settled law, and he was basically saying once the Supreme Court decides on something, it becomes settled law from then on.
Right. Correct.
So I'm trying to put in perspective his own rulings from that. But let's move on. What happened with his case? What was the case about that just got overturned while he was sitting happily in front of the Senate?
That one's kind of a convoluted case.
Was there clear credibility, bottom line, since we got 2 minutes? Is there a clear credibility question?
Well, the High Court basically unanimously overruled him. Okay, this was a disability decision that the judge wrote in 2008, and as you can see, it kind of worked its way through the system. All right, the opinion was written in Edward V. versus Douglas County School District. You know, and I can't do it in 2 minutes. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to bow on this one because this one will take a lot of time. There's no way to do it. You just asked a very complicated question, you know?
Got it. So in the last 90 seconds, what should LGBT people be looking at in this current mess? What should we be most concerned about?
The biggest problem right now is that we need to be supportive as a community of the trans community, because they're the ones that are at the tip of the spear. They are in very, very mortal danger. It is a big problem. So we need to band together and uphold our trans brothers and sisters. That's the biggest thing we need to do. Okay? Without
Perfect.
A doubt.
Thank you
they're,
so much.
They're in trouble.
And right. And that should be our mantra. That should be our focus. Watch for that as this stuff goes down, different legislation, especially at the local level. That's where it's going to happen in a very, very big way. You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. Brody Levesque, thank you so much. Check him out on newcivilrightsmovement.com. Incredible pieces. And I'm your host, Rob Watson. You find me at Of All Equals. And back here next week on Rated LGBT Radio. We will see you then.